Our in-depth guest today is Paula Becker, author of the new memoir, A House on Stilts, Mothering in the Age of Opioid Addiction, from University of Iowa Press. The book tells the story of Paula's son, Hunter, raised in a close, supportive, and loving family, who later falls victim to heroin addiction and spirals into a life of desperation and homelessness. Paula and her husband, Barry, do everything they can to help Hunter while still trying to keep their marriage together and protect Hunter's younger siblings, Sawyer and Lily. Andrew Solomon, a writer and professor of clinical psychology, calls A House on Stilts a remarkable book and an utterly terrifying one. Personally, I would add that it's also an utterly heartbreaking one. Paula Becker, thanks for joining us today on KABU.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Paula, you've written several books previous to A House on Stilts, mostly in your role as a professional historian. When you decided to tell your son Hunter's story as a memoir, you've said you had to grapple with whose story it really was, and you ultimately decided it was your story, and you had the right to tell it. What went through your mind during that decision process? What were your reservations?
Well, you know, I had thought quite a lot about memoir and whose story is being told. I wrote a biography of Betty McDonald, who wrote The Egg and I and other memoirs, and the Mrs. Pigglewiggle book, and of course, her writing was autobiographical, and so I had thought a lot as I was working on that about what it meant to be written about and whose story was being told. So when I turned to writing my own story, I already was a little bit ahead in that I understood that it was okay to have ownership over my own story. The decision to publish that is, I think, a separate decision, because I could tell my own story, and I am a writer, so I could write my story. The decision to publish it would have impact on other people, and especially on my son, Hunter. I started working on this during Hunter's lifetime, and ultimately set it aside and turned back to it after his death in the summer of 2017.
Now, you write early in the book, and I'm quoting from the book here, "When Hunter was young, I never questioned my assumption that my love and good care were check marks on a balance sheet, deposits in a bank account from which he and even I could later draw. I tried to be my best, trusting that if I did my mothering job extremely well, he would flourish forever." I think that's something almost all mothers assume, all parents. Can you tell us a little about Hunter as a child?
Hunter was a kid who never did anything according to any of the baby books, right? So what to expect from your 2-year-old.
Yes, I read those.
You know, he was my first, so I thought, well, gosh, these books are just, they don't know what they're talking about. But it was really that Hunter was just a very unique and sprightly and vibrant little person. He walked at 9 months old. He slept very little as a baby, which was challenging for a first-time mother to come up to speed with that. And he loved, you know, climbing really high, and he was very daring and physically brave, and he read really early, and he was curious, and just a really, really deep intelligence in a bright little person.
Now, you write in the book, too, I was wondering, when you started getting signs that Hunter was not flourishing as you expected, you write, "People who knew Hunter described him as extremely likable and equally intense. Intense meant this: Hunter had the quality of a lost person or someone without a map, even when he should have had one. Even when he was experienced in a situation, he often acted as if it were new or unknown." And that's probably something that wasn't in the baby books growing up. How did you react to that? Did you figure that was just who he was?
Yes, at the time, absolutely. And you know, that passage that you just read, I was thinking as I was listening to you reading it, that, of course, I had the benefit by the time I wrote that of, you know, hindsight over his whole life. And so whereas that aspect of feeling like things were new even when they should be experienced for him, that is a summation of sort of a pattern that I saw at the end of his life. You know, I could recognize it once I had a little distance. At the time that he was a kid, you know, we thought, well, this is just how Hunter is, and we will encourage him to, you know, develop more foresight, or, you know, remind him that this is something that happened before. And in particular, he was really easily frustrated when Sawyer, his younger brother, you know, wouldn't play along with whatever particular scheme or game he had. And Sawyer realized that and kind of, you know, that was a powerful thing for him. And we would tell Hunter, you know, don't let him get your goat. And you're giving him your goat, we would say, because it really was like he was just saying, you know, take it. And so, you know, part of that is parenting. You try to teach a kid, and you have a teachable moment, and you say, okay, what did we learn from this? And, you know, it wasn't anything that was so obvious that at all that we thought, well, there's something wrong here. But in retrospect, I think that there were aspects of that that led Hunter to be less cautious about a lot of the decisions he made as a middle teenager. And that was something that ended up being very, very bad for him.
And one of those decisions he made when he was a middle teenager was starting to use opiates when he was in high school. And apparently the disappearance of Reynolds Wrap or aluminum foil kind of got your suspicions up. What was the connection between that, the aluminum foil, and finding out about Hunter's using?
Well, you know, we had been struggling from about his sophomore year with issues of his truancy. He was so smart. So if he liked a class, he would go and he would get really good grades. If he didn't like it, he would blow it off. And we did this kind of cat and mouse game that had to do with where he was in school and if he was there. And then, you know, he was hanging out with kids that we didn't think were very good for him. And clearly he was smoking. And then sometimes he was drinking and he was sneaking out. So we had been these things that some teenagers use to test the boundaries, he was using full force. And by the time he was a senior, and we started noticing that the aluminum foil was disappearing and smelling this kind of funny, weird smell, although we could never find him producing that smell, we realized eventually, finally, I realized after kind of Googling my way into Reynolds Wrap, burned, you know, and he had written this word fen on pieces of paper that I would find when I searched through his room, as I frantically often did, and I realized that word meant fentanyl. Now, this was 2010. Fentanyl was not something that was on really anybody's radar at that point. It was not, you know, now this illicitly manufactured fentanyl that's being mixed with heroin or that's been being made into, you know, fake oxycodone pills and killing people, that was not yet happening. So this was a medical-grade fentanyl, as we eventually learned from probably patches that are used for people who have, for palliative care, for people and for animals at end-of-life stage. And they were cut into pieces and sold and smoked, basically. And that was what the Reynolds Wrap was for. Absolutely horrifying.
You write in the book that since they were cut into those patches, you never knew how much of a dosage you were getting. It could have been very little. It could be almost an overdose at times.
Exactly. Well, it easily could have been an overdose. And I learned that, you know, in the course of writing this book. At the time when we found out, we weren't even sure exactly what the method of getting the fentanyl onto the Reynolds Wrap was. When I was doing the research on the book, and my editor at University of Iowa Press encouraged me to really dial down on, you know, some of the specifics of things that when they were happening to us, I didn't care where he was getting it. I just wanted to get him into rehab, right? But then now you can go back. And so I talked to the people at the University of Washington who study those things, and they were the ones who explained to me, oh, yeah, you know, I mean, these are timed release, so you might get a little, you might get a lot. So it's extremely dangerous thing to do.
Now, that discovery when you first found out about the fentanyl and Hunter started using opiates, again, you tried to get help for him, and it was a very costly process, which you go over in the book, both financially and emotionally. Hunter, unfortunately, continued to relapse, often into periods of homelessness. Paulie, you wrote so vividly about that that I really felt in your shoes each step of the way, and I think most readers will. And it was hard enough just reading it, and I can only imagine how excruciating it must have been to live through it. How did you and your husband, Barry, get through this?
You know, I think the fact that we had each other was enormous. We were intent on trying to help Hunter, absolutely, but we were just as intent on trying to protect his younger siblings from just the absolute blast of all of this coming at them. And I think we were as successful as we could have been. The other thing is that Barry and I, you know, we would take turns on who was sort of dealing with specific hard things about Hunter at a certain time. And also we agreed really probably 99% of the time on what our actions should be. And for example, you know, the idea of putting him out of the house when we discovered that he was using heroin in the basement after he had relapsed, after going away to his first inpatient rehab. You know, Hunter knew that if we said you cannot use this drug in this house, you have younger siblings and it is illegal. You know, your father has a medical license. I mean, Barry's a doctor. Like, we could, you cannot have someone, you know, doing that in the house. Did we want him to be on the street? We absolutely did not. But he couldn't do that in the house, and we didn't have to do more than look each other in the eye, and we knew that that was our decision, you know. And I think a lot of couples who go through this, the issues that come up around the child's addiction split the parents from each other. And with Barry and me, that didn't happen. And I realize what a blessing that is.
Now, after you did tell him that he couldn't live in the basement anymore and not to come back home until he cleaned up, there were a few times when he did come back and you let him in. There was one time when he was very sick and you kind of nursed him back to health. And then after he recovered, he was on his way out again and you asked him, will you be back? And he answered, Mom, I don't think I can. And that was extremely heart-wrenching for me just reading it. It seemed like he knew he couldn't change, he couldn't escape. Did you also feel that hopelessness at that point, or was hope always there for you?
I felt a lot of despair, and at that moment I felt quite despondent, but I always had hope too, because I knew that Hunter was a really smart person, and I knew that he was deep and he was thoughtful. I didn't understand nearly as much as I came to over time about addiction and how insidious it is, an opioid addiction, and the way that it affects a person's brain. But I feel like the hope was there. What I didn't understand early on was that there was nothing I could do to make him decide to, stop using drugs or to go into treatment or to abstain from using them, that had to be a decision that he had to make. And that was when I finally realized that, I actually had more hope then, because I knew that I had been doing everything I could do and it wasn't working. And it's like, oh, Hunter has to make that decision. Well, I can just be with him and love him. And the whole time that he was, living on the street or he was in different sober housing places, we were always in contact with him. We were always seeing him and talking to him, sometimes multiple times a week. He was always on our cell phone, and he always knew that if he was ready to, try to get clean, that we were ready to help him. So it wasn't that we said, you know, you've got to go out and do this on your own. We were willing to offer him a certain kind of help, and he was for a long time not willing to accept that kind of help. And that's a really hard thing for a parent.
And the
and
book
for him too.
And in the book, you do write about all the steps you took to help him over and over again. Rehab programs. You tried drugs that block the effects of opioids. Something called sober homes, including one Hunter stayed at in Beaverton, but nothing worked, unfortunately. What's the lock that opioids have on our children? Is it purely physiological?
Well, for a young person, it's attractive to be able to escape into something like what I understand the effects of opioids to be from reading. I also think that there are behaviors that go along with drug use that can be in and of themselves addicting, and especially for a young person, a lot of it is using with other people in the beginning. And I won't say it's a social thing because that sort of trivializes it. It's a bonding experience. And, you know, Hunter was very bonded to our family. We practiced attachment parenting, and we were all attached to each other. And I think what happened to him in high school when he started experimenting with drugs and when he developed this group of friends who were not good for him was that he attached to them and he attached to the behaviors that they were all experimenting with together. And attachment is an incredibly strong thing, and fighting it is something that is not easily done. And he became attached to opioids, and I think a lot of kids, you know, now we know they do that. And the drugs that are out there right now are so dangerous. And sometimes, I mean, we had a lot of sort of warning, time to worry, time to try to react in different ways. There are people now who, you know, they might be worried, oh, my kid's starting to vape. And then the kid gets a you know, pill that's cut with fentanyl, and the kid is dead. And that can happen, you know, in a heartbeat. It's very frightening.
Now, you mentioned that this was early in that age of opioid addiction that you have in the book subtitled, what you call in the book, the zeitgeist of opioid addiction. Now things have advanced a little. I mean, the epidemic has gotten worse, but there's more support. So I wonder, what do you recommend for parents or really any friend or family member trying to help a loved one who is addicted to opioids?
Well, you know, it is wonderful that there is more support. It's tragic that the reason is because there's a much larger community that is struggling with this. What I think that parents can do is get support for themselves and try to get help in strategizing ways to best use the rehab system that we have, which is not perfect. I think that there are organizations now, for example, there's a group called Shatterproof, which is a national organization, not very well known on the West Coast. They're based in New York, and they have a tremendous number of resources for family members trying to help people get through the maze of choosing an addiction program. They're actually right now in a big program where they are rating evidence-based rehab programs. Now, you might think, oh, that's, of course, that's out there, and it's not, you know. And the difference between, you know, 12-step, which works for some people very well and for other people not at all, and I feel like the younger you are, the harder it is for 12-step maybe to be something that resonates with you. So there have to be other things than 12-step. And when we were going through this, that was pretty much all we could find, more or less. And there are a lot of other options now. I think also the idea of harm reduction drugs like Suboxone and Naltrexone, those can be very, very powerful aids to people who are trying to stay off of opioids. And they are, you know, they work to help with opioid addiction. They don't help for meth or other drugs, but for opioids. Those should be considered a resource and not as something that, you know, perpetuates the addiction, because they absolutely don't, in my opinion.
Now, you mentioned in the book, Paula, that Hunter was born in late January. I think that was 1992.
February 1st.
Oh, February 1st. Okay, which yeah. means he has a birthday coming up in a few weeks. Yeah. I was wondering, do you and your family do anything special on that day to honor?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked me that, because I do something. I have a personal kind of a ritual that I developed the first year after he was killed, and I wanted to focus on his birthday, on childhood and what was good and what was happy in his life. And so we used to go to lots and lots of parks around Seattle. I wrote for a parenting magazine, and I was always taking the kids to different parks. So what I do is I go to a store that sells little polished rocks or crystals, and I buy some hematites, because he loved hematites, those kind of silvery metallic rocks. And then I buy amethyst because those are his birthstone. And I take in about four or five of them, of each one, and then I go to parks around Seattle where Hunter played, and I find a place where I don't think a little kid who's going to choke on a rock is going to find it, but like an older kid, like up on a slide. And I leave the rock and I say, this rock is in memory of Hunter Brown, who played here when he was young. May the child who finds this have a blessed life with little pain and much joy. And I, that's the ritual that I do on his birthday every year. And I just bought the rocks yesterday, so I'm all ready.
Well, Paula, thanks so much for talking with us. I know it's a difficult subject, but it's a wonderful book. And thank you for sharing Hunter's story in that book and with us at KBOO today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you asking me about it.
We've been talking with Seattle-based author Paula Becker about her new memoir, A House on Stilts, Mothering in the Age of Opioid Addiction, from University of Iowa Press. Paula will be reading and signing books at Powell's City of Books in downtown Portland tomorrow, Tuesday, January 7th at 7:30 p.m. You can learn more about Paula and her work online at paulabecker.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.